Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to episode 170 of The Naturalist Capitalist. We're working our way up to 200. We'll be there before you know it. Back on the show again on the other end, I've got my friend Dak Rouleau. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Doing good. Made sure we got everything we need for a discussion about Rittenhouse. Before anybody freaks out, don't worry. There's no magazine in here. It's completely unloaded as far as I know. But yeah, we're here for a good discussion tonight.
Absolutely. So before we get into Rittenhouse, I've been messaging you lately. I've been going through a lot of our old videos, and I don't know if I'm happy or sad about how much we've been right about things, specifically you and me, because we did a lot of videos last year and at the beginning of this year, and we talked about a lot of different subjects, whether it was economic upheaval, inflation, whether it was Joe Biden being just as authoritarian or maybe even worse than Trump, whether it had to do with progressives completely, detaching from what little bit of reality they were still attached to at the beginning of the year, whatever it was. Like, I went back and watched our January 6th thing. I think we did it on the night of January 7th.
I saw you post about that. Yeah, with Marcus Cage. That was only 3 or 4 days after the riot occurred. Yep.
I think it was the day after, actually. It was.
Oh, really?
Okay. It was January 7th. And everything that we assumed was going to happen as a result of that is happening. The narratives that were going to be constructed, the legislation they were going to try to push. So I wanted to ask you, does it feel good to be right about almost everything, or does it feel bad because it's like, well, here we go, or is it sort of a mixture of the two?
I wouldn't say it feels bad because I didn't like the way that society was prior to us being proven right on every single thing that we predicted. And so with that being said, I would say that I feel mental clarity has been proven right. It's like, okay, I'm insane, at least not to the extent that I was. And so where I've found a sense of clarity since the riot is getting away from progressivism completely. During the Tulsi Gabbard campaign, I abandoned my libertarian roots and tried to fall in with progressivism. I've now come to resent progressivism in everything it represents. I don't think it's a legitimate ideology. I think it's just a romanticized vision of socialism. And I do have certain socialist sympathies, but I think that what socialism accomplishes psychologically is ultimately deleterious. And so I feel a sense of validation and vindication coming from the fact that we were right about basically everything. I don't use it as a point of depression at all. If anything, it's just going to fuel my megalomaniacal complex.
Yeah. So for any of my new viewers who don't know Dak, Dak was a Ron Paul supporter in, was it just 2012 or was it also 2008?
I was too stupid in 2008. I'm not going to pretend I was woke on the day that I was born, like a lot of other people do.
All right. So 2012, he worked on the Ron Paul campaign.
I didn't work on it. I just supported him.
You supported him. In 2020, both of us ended up. You didn't really even volunteer on the Tulsi campaign, did you?
I was an embedded correspondent. I was basically just hanging out with her a lot while I harassed the other presidential candidates trying to get them on Julian Assange. So,
yeah, so we were both involved with the Tulsi Gabbard campaign, and there were a lot of Ron Paul supporters who were on that campaign, which I found very interesting. I did not abandon my libertarian roots while I was on that campaign. I considered myself a pragmatic supporter of hers. And actually, I think working that campaign radicalized me a little bit to how much I actually disagreed with progressives, because I don't know if you ever witnessed that. I'm sure you did, because I've heard you talk about it with some of her stances on things. She would try to articulate a position, and then we'd get to a point where she was describing it, where it became so obvious that it was contradicting itself. And it was like, wait a second, did you see that happening a lot with a lot of her positions on things?
Not so much a lot. I remember we went to that notorious town hall in Rochester, New Hampshire, the night before Thanksgiving, where she was supposed to be talking about gun control. And after listening to her talk for an hour, I still don't know what her stance on gun control is. My wife, Christy, of course, said the same thing, that she listened to that town hall as well and doesn't know where she stands on the issue. But then, of course, the big contradiction was when she endorsed Joe Biden, who, of course, is the antithesis of everything that she claimed to stand for. Basically, where the campaign radicalized me was abandoning this idea of representative government. I agree completely with Mike Gravel, rest in peace, who said that representative government is the problem. I think that if you're going to support democracy, you need to support direct democracy. This concept of republicanism is just completely ridiculous. And I think republicanism is a euphemism for reformism. And I don't agree with any of it. I don't agree with democracy either. But where I think the Tulsi Gabbard campaign helped to radicalize me was in the sense that anytime you're involved in some kind of group effort, if you're in a situation where you're like trying to appeal to a large mass of people, that is where you are inevitably going to be frustrated, because you find that the compulsion to groupthink ultimately outweighs the capacity for independent thought. Intellectual rigor is going to be sacrificed in order to appeal the mob. And that's why I will never actively support a political campaign ever again.
Yeah, I remember right after she endorsed Joe Biden, coming on your show was actually my first media appearance ever. I was not even the naturalist capitalist at that point. I didn't have a channel, didn't have a social media presence of any kind, and you had me on to talk about it. And I do remember that instantly, as soon as we weren't even really dragging her through the mud in that video. We were just showing discontent for the endorsement. And instantly, all these people, a lot of people that I had sort of respected and thought of as somewhat critical thinkers, they just swarmed us, and we were the enemy instantly. I always thought that was interesting.
Well, I remember showing that, or not that specifically, but some of the critical tweets I made about Tulsi Gabbard to some people who are not unplugged from the matrix. These are people who are completely blue-pilled. And they looked at my tweets and they said, "Why are people so upset with you?" And I said, "Well, I'm criticizing Tulsi Gabbard." And people said, "Yeah, but you're not calling her a bitch. You're not like saying, fuck you. Like, you're not being disrespectful or vulgar or inappropriate. So why are people getting angry?" And that sort of, that took me back for a second. And I realized this is how far gone we go in these political worshiping circles, is that people think the slightest bit of criticism, however valid or warranted it may be, is tantamount to blasphemy. It's the problem of apostasy. People want to worship this person, savior or the redeemer, and then when they fail to live up to that expectation, any criticism is going to be received as apostasy. You are sacrificing the Holy One. And it's really not, I'm not especially interested in Tulsi Gabbard per se, because I don't know her as a human being, despite the fact that I met her 75 times. It's not like we were friends or anything like that. It's just, I was more interested in the psychological phenomenon of the people who worship her, because I think that's what happens with every political campaign, is that the unflattering, unbecoming truth is sacrificed in the interest of trying to support this political deity.
Yeah, and as you're kind of pointing to, this is not anything exclusive to Tulsi Gabbard. You saw it with Trump, saw it with Bernie. You somehow see it with Biden with some people, which is weird because the man has no personality, but they still latch on to the man, Biden. This is where I really, I really would say I disconnect from a lot of my peers, is I'm not loyal to politicians at all. I'm loyal to principles. And if politicians adhere to those principles, then, you know, we'll have some alignment. But as soon as they abandon them, I don't think that means you necessarily should completely write somebody off, but you should not excuse their abandonment of whatever principles you stand for because your favorite person is deciding to abandon them. I don't think that's the way it should work, at least.
It's the issue that I took with the idea that this person, whoever it is going to save the nation. Like it's you can say whatever you want about Tulsi Gabbard's positions, but what the lesson that we should take away from it is obviously that if you are a good person, these political organizations are not going to permit you to become president. In order to become president, you have to appease either the Democratic or Republican Party, which are both multi-billion dollar corporations with their own special interests and agendas and structures. And so you have to overcome that. And so if a person is going to overcome that, they have to sacrifice their principles. So to me, it just said that regardless of how you feel about Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders or whoever, the lesson that we should take from 2020 is these political solutions that are promoted by the mainstream are dead. And I have no doubt that these progressives will find some other Sisyphean rock to roll up the hill within the next few years. In 2024 or 2028, there will come along some other progressive mascot. Maybe they'll get behind Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or somebody similar. And they are going to try to pin their hope for reform on that person, and they will be inevitably disappointed. The closest we ever came to this was probably in 2008 when Barack Obama won. And there were a lot of people like myself who thought, oh, good, things are going to get a little bit better now. Disillusionment took over within 2 years. Like, I don't know how much more people have to see and experience before they finally come to terms with the fact that these political solutions, if they ever were functional in the past, they have become completely antiquated in the present.
Yeah, this is why I think libertarianism is the only movement that can succeed, because while it technically is a political movement, it is also an apolitical movement that relies on individual change, individual enlightenment, saving yourself before you save others, where all these other movements, conservatism, liberalism, progressivism, they require some sort of collective action and some sort of systemic change to take place. Where libertarianism, a big piece of it is change yourself, whether or not the system changes, save yourself, save the ones around you, encourage other people to save themselves. And once enough people save themselves from the system will collapse. I think it's the only legitimate ideology that can actually progress, I guess, or become something.
Libertarianism advocates that if the federal government must exist, then it should have no political power whatsoever and very, very little administrative power, as little administrative power as possible. Progressivism is fundamentally flawed because it posits the idea that the problem we have of a corrupt government is to give the government exponentially more power than it possesses at present, which is just lunacy. And this is ironically one of the main criticisms of libertarianism. People say that, well, you're giving more and more power to the capitalists who are running this country into the ground. That is not accurate, but it is accurate to say of progressivism that it does advocate for an even more convoluted and powerful central state in order to solve the problems of authoritarianism and totalitarianism. I mean, I lost faith in progressivism when the pandemic began, and they were perfectly fine surrendering their rights to the government as long as the government was compensating them in the form of stimulus checks. This is one of the reasons why I stopped listening to Jimmy Dore completely, is because he never had the courage, whether it was intellectual or spiritual, to say that we are living in a state of martial law now that the authoritarian medical industrial complex has taken over. People say is that the government should be more stimulus check. To me, you're missing the point. It's like saying that your rapist should wear a condom. And that's why I don't have respect for these progressive commentators anymore, and why I've moved off of them completely, is because you're entirely missing the point if you think that state power is the solution to these problems.
Yeah, what I've noticed is interesting throughout the pandemic, or whatever you want to call it, and all the lockdown hysteria and everything, is very few people were willing to put their political careers on the line early on. When it was unpopular to be against this tyranny, very, very few people were willing to stand up. Now that it's become more politically acceptable, Jimmy Dore is a name you get, like, now he is against a lot of this stuff, but so is Ron DeSantis, and so is most of the Republican Party at this point. But it takes zero gall to be against it now. Now it's almost politically advantageous because we've seen how it played out. It was a disaster. A good chunk of the public stands against this now. So the people who were willing to actually sacrifice their political, you know, their political status, their, you know, their public, you know, their public image of caring or humanity was completely wiped away. You know, if they were willing to stand, like, I remember when, Thomas Massie demanded that there be a roll call recorded vote on the CARES Act. I mean, he was just demonized by everybody as someone that wanted you to die without stimulus and didn't want you to get your money. It's just amazing how the media will twist these things and how few people will stand up against it in the beginning. But then once it becomes politically advantageous, everybody files up in line and, you know, they do their thing.
Well, that's what was problematic at the beginning, was how frightening it was. And I understand that there were a few people who didn't want to lose their platform, so they waded waters tentatively. But at this point, with the way that things are going, if you're not willing to speak at this point, then you don't seem to realize what is actually happening here. Like, at this point, losing your YouTube channel should be the least of your worries. I mean, if you're not willing to come out and criticize the authoritarianism of the pandemic explicitly at a fundamental philosophical level, then there's no reason for you to have a YouTube channel. There's no reason for you to have a platform at all. I mean, I put out a video recently where I was talking about YouTube's vaccine misinformation policy. And I explained in that video that I don't advocate for alternative medicine because I don't know enough about those subjects in order to speak intelligently. I can't tell you what to take in order to prevent or cure a disease. But I can say that authoritarianism is wrong. I can say that fascism is wrong. And the argument that I've made from the beginning, which has not changed, is I don't care if the bubonic plague is raging outside. The federal government should not have the power to force everyone into a state of indefinite house arrest and to assume complete control of the economy, like in North Korea or something, simply because the government claims that there is a biological emergency mandating such executive control. Because then you set a precedent that all the government has to do in the future is claim that we're struggling with this disease, and voila, they have that executive privilege. You have to take that away from them at the basic level. So you have to be willing to say, I don't care if the bubonic plague is raging outside. They should not have the right to force me into my home. And if you're worried about people saying, well, that sounds a little extreme to me, then you're missing the point. Like, I mean, why should that position be banned from YouTube? That has nothing to do with medical misinformation. It's a philosophical position. I mean, if you're not willing to make that point, then I'm not saying you're a bad person or you're stupid, but I do think you have a bit more learning to do. You have to recognize what court you're playing.
Yeah, I remember the first time I had you on my channel, you said that, which was in either June or July of last year, when there was still a ton of hysteria. People had no idea what was going on. And I agreed with you that, you know, it's the principle that matters. You have to, you know, so many people are saying, well, now that we've seen that the disease isn't as serious as we thought, you know, maybe we shouldn't have done what we did. And you're right, they're still missing the point. It's like, no, it doesn't matter how bad the disease is. I remember I was praising Ron DeSantis, which is rare, but when he was when he was standing against this absolute craziness and saying, you know, people in Florida should be able to do what they want and businesses should be able to decide what they want, a few months ago. And I was arguing with someone when I was still on Twitter saying, I don't care if every citizen ends up dying in Florida from the coronavirus. My point is that Ron DeSantis is doing the right thing by not mandating how businesses run themselves. And that's the principle that I'm standing on. It has nothing to do with the outcome of how many people end up being healthy, how many people end up dying, whatever. And ironically, right now, Florida, I think, has some of the lowest COVID cases in the entire country, which is interesting. But you're right. The principle is what matters, not, you know, not the outcome, not how serious the disease is, none of that stuff.
But let me just ask you one question. If there was no pressure whatsoever, there was no threatened censorship on social media, there was no law stating that you have to wear a mask or you have to maintain your social distancing, you have to be vaccinated, etc. You didn't have to worry about, there was no law saying any of that stuff, and you were just looking at how society has changed during this pandemic. what percent of the population would actually be frightened of the disease?
Much less.
Exactly. Yeah. What this has been, the digital pandemic. What we have witnessed is the transformation from a kind of practical lived society to an experienced society that that takes place entirely over the digital airwaves. People are, the last election might as well have been held on the internet because people were living in the fictitious world of the electronic media because they were forbidden to organize with each other. They were, their only form of organization was responding to what people said on CNN. And so this fictitious synthetic society in which we are living, people are beginning to recognize the artificiality of it. And I hope that that is what was expressed in the gubernatorial race in Virginia. But as I said at the beginning of this video, I don't believe in these political solutions anymore. And the Republicans have proven themselves to be completely useless in combating the authoritarianism of the pandemic. I mean, Rand Paul argues with Fauci, the dog killer, all the time about the coronavirus, but he engages Fauci on his own terms. He tries to argue that, no, the science is incorrect. You are misrepresenting the data, etc. That isn't the point. The point is he should be advocating from a philosophical position. This should not be at all. When you say that Fauci's misrepresenting the data, you're implying, however indirectly, that if the data were correct, then we would be justified in locking people in their homes forevermore.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Actually, I think it was before I got removed from Twitter, I saw that Rand Paul tweeted something out about the numbers, saying that because these numbers are so low, it points out that the political action that we took was not justified. And then the Libertarian Party of Kentucky quote tweeted it, correcting him, saying basically what you said, that no, it doesn't matter how good or bad the disease or vaccines or anything are. It's the philosophical point that the government doesn't have the right to run your life. But you know what we're getting at here is, you were talking about the synthetic society we live in that the media creates, this alternate reality. I titled this episode Establishment Lynch Mobs. So we are going to talk specifically about the Rittenhouse case, but on a grander scale, the government creates a lynch mob to get, or I shouldn't say the government because it's not just the government, the establishment media, government, big state, whatever narrative, creates this world where it demonizes dissent and tries to get everybody to think a certain way about certain people before any facts hit the ground. And they did this with Derek Chauvin. They've done it with Kyle Rittenhouse. I just wanted your comment on that. Do you think that this is completely intentional or accidental, or people are stupid, or what is this?
It's definitely deliberate. There was a website I used to go to long ago called SlateStarCodex.com. I haven't been there in a long time, but I remember this was before Trump even ran for president, I believe. The man who ran that website wrote an article where he was talking about how in the case of police shootings of unarmed black men, the media deliberately selects cases that are ambiguous, meaning that they're amenable to controversy. And the example this was before BLM became this like ultra mainstream thing in 2020. This was long before that. He was talking about how like the Trayvon Martin case is a great example, because in the Trayvon Martin case, there's no surveillance footage, there's no security footage, there's no real eyewitness accounts. We don't know what actually happened that night. So there's room for debate. You can argue that Trayvon Martin was innocent. You can argue that Trayvon Martin was a drugged out predator. Like there's this room for debate without any possibility for resolution, because we'll never know the truth. And what the media has done in recent years is we've seen that they've been adopting a similar view where they ignore cases like the Walter Scott shooting in North Carolina, which was unambiguously a case of police abuse. And the police officer was actually sentenced, I think, to 25 years in prison for killing him. With the Kyle Rittenhouse case, there's all this controversy where, yeah, it probably wasn't very smart of him to go drive over there or have his mom drive him. And then he's brandishing an AR-15. But at the same time, we don't know for sure that his life was not being threatened by the protesters. And so it's this it's a conflict without any means of a serious solution, because regardless of how this case is adjudicated, half of the people watching are going to be furious with the verdict. And so all it is it becomes to us a completely fruitless, unproductive source of hate porn. And where I've come with the Rittenhouse case specifically is I don't pretend to know the facts. I don't know if he operated or if he acted in self-defense. I don't know. I don't particularly care, but I want him to walk just because I am so disgusted with this moral pomposity that is expressed by the mainstream so-called left. I want this donut Twitter world that I'm not even a part of to be rocked and heartbroken when they see him walk out free. That is what I want. And that may sound petty. People can say that I'm just looking to own the libs. But I mean, is that any different from the political discourse generally? Isn't it all about just owning your enemies regardless of the validation of your cause?
Yeah, I mean, I've followed the case pretty closely. I don't really see any case for the prosecution. I mean, the only thing that I can see that you can stick them with is a misdemeanor for underage possession of a firearm. And some people are arguing with me about that. But from what I've seen, he's supposed to be 18 to be carrying it in Wisconsin. And that's the only law that I can see that he really broke. That's not a law.
That's less than 2 years in prison, most likely. So who cares?
Yeah, I mean, I don't care. Like, this whole trial over a misdemeanor is absolutely ridiculous. And that's not a law that I think should even exist. I don't think that there should be. I mean, if we got rid of the federal government, then sure, I think the states should have their own gun laws. But I mean, in living in this current country with the Constitution, I don't think that the states should be able to dictate that. And I don't think going over state lines or your age should matter or anything like that. So yeah, this whole trial is just a sham. And this is very similar to the Derek Chauvin trial, I think, in publicity. So, you know, like you said, there have been cases where there's obvious police brutality. What's his name? Eric
Garner?
Eric Shave. The guy who was shot in Arizona by the police, crawling on his hands and knees. Well, he was obviously drunk, and then the officer's like telling him to do all these different things, and then he shoots him several times with an AR-15, just straight up executes him. I'm forgetting what his name is. I think it's Daniel Shaver. I think that's his name.
Shaver sounds familiar.
Yeah. So I mean, that was just such an obvious case of police murder and brutality. Got like almost no media attention. But then you have this case where the media and the Democratic Party and everything just instantly jumped on it. I mean, the same day that George Floyd died, there was just this massive media propaganda behind it. And if you didn't agree with it, like, you were evil. And it was before any facts were brought to light, before any trial had been done. Like, that trial was over before it started.
Yeah.
And I feel like the same thing is happening here with the Rittenhouse case, although I feel like there's just absolutely no case for the prosecution. I can't imagine Rittenhouse won't walk. And if I almost feel like at this point, there's going to be more unrest if he doesn't walk than if he does, just because I don't know how much of this thing you've seen, but it's just, it's a joke watching it.
Well, there's an issue with the Rittenhouse case that nobody is talking about, but I'm going to talk about it. Years ago at overwritten.org, I wrote an article about Nicholas Sandman. For those who don't recall, Nicholas Sandman was the teenager with the Make America Great Again hat who was falsely accused of racist taunting of a Native American man during a trip to the Capitol or something like that. He was falsely accused by the media of it, and he sued various media outlets. He got a multi-million dollar settlement, from what I understand. And the emphasis in that case was always on the facts. Like, was he actually taunting the man or was he not? To me, the lesson of that case should have been, don't involve minors in this stuff. The guy is under the age of 18. He should not be the subject of nightly news commentary. Like, I don't care what the guy was doing. I don't care if he walked up to that man and shouted every racial epithet in the book. He's under the age of 18. It is not fair game for the media to go after him like that. And in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, there is this vengeance, this bloodlust that is expressed by the left, where they want to see him raped and murdered in prison when he was under the age of 18 when he did this. That doesn't mean he can't be held criminally liable for what he did, but the idea that they want someone who was under the age of 18 at the time to just, they're looking at him like he's Hitler or something like that, it really does illustrate the moral depravity of this country. And yes, I know I'm saying that while I have a gun in my hand, but that's the point I'm trying to make, is we have become this buffoonish parody of some kind of decent morality, and it's disgusting. There was that woman who went on Twitter recently and said that the image, the face Rittenhouse made when he cried will be the first face he makes when he is raped in the prison showers. I mean, like, that kind of commentary. And yeah, I can find those jokes amusing sometimes. But if you're trying to present yourself as some kind of moral authority, like you are so pristine and you sit on your high horse and look down on the grubby MAGA people with their hideous moral code, then you probably shouldn't be making comments like that. And that point has been missed completely in all this, that it should be the case of, oh, isn't it so sad that a minor got caught up in this and now his, like, there's all this blood on the streets. It's so sad. Instead, it's, I want him dead.
Yeah, what I found interesting is with George Floyd and with this, for some reason, we are supposed to care about the political views of the subjects involved and not their innocence or guilt. So, and not just their political views, but also whether or not they're upstanding people. So, you know, there was a lot of right wing exposure to what a piece of shit George Floyd was, which he was. But it was like, okay, what does this have to do with the case at hand? And then there are people pointing out, like, oh, you know, Rittenhouse loved the cops and he was a bootlicker. And I'm like, this is completely disconnected from what happened in Kenosha.
One of the guys he shot was sentenced to 15 years in prison for molesting young
boys. Yes. Yeah. So, I don't understand, or I shouldn't say I don't understand, because I do understand, but it's discouraging and enraging to me that it's gotten to the point where this has become, with every case, it's a character assessment of everything else they've done in their lives instead of what happened on the day in question and relates to the case at hand. That's just really annoying.
Well, that was kind of like the Tara Reid situation. The woman who accused Biden of raping her, was there was all of this screw about what her political were, and the conclusion I was that there was no view that she could have had that could not be used against her. If she was a Democrat who voted for Obama, then she's a hypocrite. If she was a Republican, then she has an ulterior motive. If she's a third party voter, then she has an ulterior motive trying to take Biden down. I mean, that's what's going on here with Rittenhouse. Is if he is a Republican, that means he went to that rally with vicious intent. But again, since he's under the age of 18, I don't know that he could have had a party affiliation formally. If he's a Democrat, you could also try to use that against him, that, well, wait, what was he doing if he was at this rally? He didn't actually understand the Democratic Party. Like the political views are entirely beside the point. There's nothing that you, no view that you can have that can't be weaponized against you. I mean, it's a total non sequitur, but then again, the mainstream media is not known for, it's not, the mainstream media is definitely not above committing logical fallacies.
Yeah. Also, what's interesting is, you know, I do hate that we're supposed to care about the character of the people involved instead of just their actions and what they actually did.
Yeah.
But it is annoying how the media tries to paint these people as heroes or villains. So, you know, it looks like the only thing that they can really stick Rittenhouse with is underage possession of a firearm. When I don't remember how to pronounce his name, but the guy who survived the shooting, who's in the courtroom, he was also illegally possessing a firearm because his carry permit had expired. So if that's really what it comes down to, how is this guy any better than Rittenhouse? But then, as you pointed out, Rosenbaum, he had molested, he actually raped little boys Huber had strangled women and had other felony charges too. George Floyd, you know, he was painted as this silent, you know, this gentle giant, which was not true at all of him. Derek Chauvin, we were led to believe that he was this racist, you know, minority hating person, which was not true either. Right. I mean, just like, I just hate that, you know, all these things that they try to paint a picture with are just usually completely false, and nobody bothers to dig through any of the information at all. And also, like I said initially, this shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter in the case. Shouldn't matter how good or bad any of these people are. Like, I don't, if Kyle Rittenhouse were a member of the Ku Klux Klan, it doesn't matter. The point is, what did he do that night? Is he guilty? And that's all that we should be actually questioning.
Well, the attempts to equate him with the Ku Klux Klan are especially interesting when both of the people he killed were white. Christy was showing me earlier this tweet by this woman who said that she became red pill during this trial because she had been led to believe by the mainstream media that she relied upon that his victims were black. Kind of reminds me of when Hillary Clinton was president, you were told you were racist if you didn't vote against her when she and her running mate were white. Right. Now, with the Rittenhouse case, there's also you talked about how we're trying to make heroes out of George Floyd and Joseph Rosenbaum, and I don't remember the name of the other guy he killed. But anyway, the thing is, this is an issue in our culture of trying to replace heroism with martyrdom. I think people are heroes because of things that happened to them rather than things that they did. The idea that we have statues dedicated to George Floyd, who literally did nothing in his life except become the victim of another person's actions, this is a very bad indication of where we are psychologically in society. I did a video about this about 3 weeks ago about there was the man who was revealed that an NFL coach wrote racist comments about this attorney. And now the attorney, Damari Smith, has become a hero in the eyes of many because someone racist comments about him. Like there's an emphasis on passivity, like passive martyrs rather than heroes. And so if your role model is somebody who got shot or somebody who was choked out by a cop, and that's the only reason you know about this person is because of what they passively had happened to them, then you need to re-examine and recalibrate your moral code. I mean, your standard, you just get better role models. This is a pretty broad problem in our society. I mean, yeah, you could argue that Rosa Parks was kind of like that, but at least she made the affirmative, declarative stance that I'm going to stay where I am. Like this emphasis on passivity. I mean, if Joseph Rosenbaum is one of your heroes, you got to figure out what your principles are.
Yeah, so I am going to play a clip that I found of us from last August, just a couple days after this whole thing went down. But I think it's important to note what was happening in this country. There were riots everywhere. There were buildings on fire. There were people getting shot in the streets sometimes, not every night. But I mean, the country was a mess. Being a truck driver, you know, I was a little nervous going into California, into L.A., you know, especially in the 92 riots, man, what was that guy's name? There's a guy driving I'm blanking on names tonight, but there was a guy driving a cement truck in the 92 riots that a bunch of people pulled out of the truck and they beat his skull in and he almost died. Can't remember his name off the top of my head, but that image was in my mind a lot. And, you know, a lot of people were scared, and the government's supposed role is to protect life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and your property. And the government was not doing that last year. I mean, if anything, in instances where I noticed, the cops were only to be found abusing peaceful protesters. And then once bricks were flying through windows and cars were being tipped over and buildings were set on fire, the cops were nowhere to be found. And there were also suspicious videos of cops putting bricks out in the middle of the streets during the days. I think there were a lot of state provocateurs state provocateurs in these, you know, in these cities all around the country. But anyway, I think that it mattered to take the right position to be, you know, against more government authority, but also realize that anarcho-tyranny was taking place, which is basically just, you know, the government still exists, but it's not doing anything to stop the craziness, and it's actually encouraging it. That was what we were living through last year. And you and I understood that, and I think a lot of people missed the mark. I just wanted your comments on that, and then I'll play the clip.
Yeah, it was a form of neo-government or anti-government, where the government exists in name only. What I witnessed, actually, it's funny, was I attended a protest in Boston, Massachusetts, which was completely peaceful, except for someone throwing a water bottle at a cop, until night fell. And then when darkness took over the city, I actually went back to New Hampshire at that point. That was when people started getting into trouble. That's when people started throwing things. I think someone might have gotten like slashed in the arm with a knife, something like that, because that's when the provocateurs and the troublemakers and the ruffians came out in order to try to stir things up. What's interesting was right after that, the day after I attended that protest, that was when the FBI came to my house. Somebody had called the FBI to report me because for some reason they thought I was a dangerous person. I can't imagine why. But they came to visit me, and I mentioned to the FBI agent and the police officers who were there, I said, "Hey, you know, I've heard these conspiracy theories about people, cops leaving out bricks for troublemakers to start stuff with." And the police officer looked at me and he said, "My thought on that is I'm not going to leave a brick out for someone to throw at me later." And, you know, I thought about that for a while, and I'm like, well, that's a plausible explanation. Like, I don't know that the police officers were in on it necessarily, but I do think clearly that the government was trying to exploit this completely manufactured protest movement in order to drum up support for the Democratic Party. The image was to present a country that was completely destabilized and falling into chaos under Donald Trump. And since most people just experienced it on television rather than going to the events in person, they had a much more sensationalized image of the BLM protests than actually existed. And the last thing I'll say before you play the clip is that with that, you saw that it was undeniably astroturf. I had many arguments with people about this where I said there is nothing legitimate about these BLM protests. These are organized by professionals who know exactly what they're doing, who understand how to synchronize events so that they take place in all major cities simultaneously, that it's receiving the appropriate news coverage. I saw people who worked the Joe Biden campaign running the protest in Manchester, New Hampshire. And so I just, the idea that people thought this was somehow organic, that they were living out the modern civil rights movement. I mean, it was so embarrassing. You wonder how these people could be suckered into voting for Joe Biden. There you are.
Yeah. Just before I play the clip, I'll just comment on that I had some sympathy at the very beginning, but then I went to one of these in person in Denver, and I noticed that there was absolutely no direction to anything there. There were hundreds of people there. They had no idea what they wanted. I asked them, "You're saying no justice, no peace. What does justice mean? You need to describe that to me." None of them could. None of them knew what qualified immunity was. They didn't know what civil asset forfeiture was. They didn't know about police militarization. They didn't know about qualified immunity. So they were embracing the excitement of the moment. But yeah, this idea that there were hundreds of people out there, you know, living a second march of Martin Luther King is just absolutely ridiculous. So I'll play this clip. This is from August of last year, just a couple days after the shooting in Kenosha. This is the only time I remember talking about it. If someone finds another clip from last year where I talked about it, let me know. I was trying to comb through my stuff. This is the only place where it was brought up. So I'll just play this and then we'll react.
So you and I definitely go after the state a lot more than we do any agitators of the state. Yes. And that's because, as I mentioned earlier, they have a monopoly on violence. They're immune. They can get away with anything. Yep. So I think a lot of people, you know, somehow think that I sympathize with rioting and destruction of small businesses. That is not the case for me. I mean, there's been some videos of protesters or whatever you want to call them, jumping on tractor trailers and trying to get into the cab. And I'm a truck driver myself. If there were a protest in the street and I stopped and they jumped on my truck, I would take off in self-defense. And if there was someone coming into my neighborhood trying to attack my neighbors or trying to attack my house or attack me, I would shoot them. That is how I feel about this. So I wanted to take, I wanted to hear your take on the rioters and the destruction. What do you think?
Well, this is what I'm saying, that I'm sure that this is being orchestrated by powerful people, is that they want Americans, not all Americans, but they want a significant percentage of the population to be afraid of what's happening out in some of these cities. Right. It's not going to happen in a place like New Hampshire. But what we're seeing happen out there, yes, you're absolutely right, that if somebody is coming into your home, particularly when you have done nothing wrong, then obviously you have every right to defend yourself. Now, I'm not going to comment on this kid Rittenhouse, who may or may not have been an agitator, or who may or may not have just been an idiot who thought he was defending his community when he drove 5 hours away. It doesn't matter. But the thing is, what I believe they're attempting to do in this situation is they are training the law enforcement agencies, quote unquote, whether it's the federal stormtroopers or whether it's the military or local police or what have you, they're training them for the future disassembling of the United States. If you think that the people are getting outraged because of a shooting in Wisconsin or because of a murder in Minneapolis, the upcoming eviction of, what are they talking about now? 50 million people, something like that, are potentially facing eviction on top of the 50 million unemployed. That is when political ideology falls away in the face of the fact that you can't fill your refrigerator. And that's when people start getting violent.
So there it is. Hot stack.
I was so much skinnier back then. I mean, when I look back on myself back then, I had so much more energy. And now I just look at what a fat mediocrity I've become, and it makes me sad, but at least I have guns. It's interesting. That whole mass eviction thing they were talking about never actually occurred, did it? We never did see people, which is unfortunate because we would have seen actual rebellion, and that would have been very satisfying. But the problem is with this case is that I do still believe that the police were being trained. It was kind of like a dry run for trying to suppress civil unrest en masse in the future. I remember I mentioned I went to that Boston protest. When we got down to the police station, there was a police officer, at least one, standing on the roof actively of the police station, actively recording the masses gathered outside, taking digital evidence, photographic evidence, things that could be used in the future, facial recognition, kind of like we saw at the Capitol riot. And so I do believe that the masses were being suckered into behaving this way in order to justify mass surveillance in the future. It may not have been quite as clear cut or direct as we feared it was going to be. But I do think that there was definitely some exploitation or opportunity for increasing authoritarianism as a result of these organized protests.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting. You brought up the Rittenhouse case there, and this was only I think this was 5 days after it had taken place. And at this point, it was already heavily politically charged. And the fact that you would basically say that you're willing to admit that you don't know what's going on and it doesn't matter is kind of a radical position to take with these things. And then I liked the point that you made that if you think all of this is about a murder in Minneapolis or a shooting in Wisconsin, you're missing the point. I thought that was pretty powerful.
Yeah, my ability to admit that I don't know everything is something that makes me a pretty easy target in the independent media, because I guess we're supposed to see your word of the day is polymath. And there's no such thing as a polymath. Jimmy Dore does not know everything just because he's a progressive. That doesn't mean that as soon as he reads a news article, he understands the entirety of the facts of the case. A lot of these independent media commentators want to. It's why I tend to take my time with certain things. It takes me a few weeks or a year before I'll talk about certain subjects, just because I want to actually have some level of information before I comment thereupon. There was so much groupthink going on when the BLM protest began and Kyle Rittenhouse. I remember, though, there was a great meme I saw where all of the comic book heroes, Batman, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, etc., were lined up in a hallway bowing as Rittenhouse walked down the hall with his AR-15. And that's the point that I've come to now, is it's strictly for my own shallow vindication that I just want to see Rittenhouse walk, just because my political enemies are not going to be very happy about it. The question is, if he does in fact walk, will Kyle Rittenhouse run for president in 18 years?
I want to get him on the show if he walks. That would
really yes, happen. Yes. But he'll have a lot of people who want to talk to him first.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. Like, it's... going back to what we were talking about when we first started this episode, you just said that you're willing to admit you don't know everything. But in hindsight, you and I have been right about a lot of things. And I think it's because we have waited for the most part to try to find out what's going on before we jump on something. I've noticed even in the libertarian movement, though it's supposed to be a group of individualists and free thinkers, there are still thought leaders within that camp. And I'm friends with some of them, but like, you know, Dave Smith or Tom Woods or Ron Paul or just any of these podcasters or thought leaders, a lot of people wait to hear what they have to say before they're willing to make a judgment. But then as soon as that person has made his judgment, everyone is willing to line up behind them without doing any critical thought themselves. And I see that in the libertarian movement, but once you get outside of the libertarian movement, it gets way, way worse. Once it's the conservative movement or the progressive movement, there are really just a few people who are doing all of the thinking for the masses. And the further you get away from libertarianism, like the more you get toward just whatever corporate media sludge is being fed to you, the content gets dumber and the thought figures become fewer. And that's just a really horrifying realization.
Well, as Friedrich Nietzsche once said, when we find we must change our opinion of a man, we hold the inconvenience he causes us very much against him. And that's something I live by very seriously, which is why I try to be wrong as seldom as possible, but why I have to admit immediately when I have made mistakes. I mean, I just really, don't know how much I should hate myself for what I wrote, the propaganda I wrote to try to help Tulsi Gabbard, because I was just starting out with this media stuff. And so it was like my roots, I suppose. But yeah, I have felt liberated since I got off of Twitter and have gone away from the echo chamber and the groupthink. I remember one of the first things you and I talked about was how the people were saying that the election of 2020 was stolen, like the results were falsified. And there was serious pressure on us to say that we thought Donald Trump won the election and that it was just someone in government falsified the votes to help Biden. We were willing to say, I think that there are a lot of NPCs in this country who could be persuaded to get off the ballot for the guy, not Donald Trump. And simply by acknowledging that and acknowledging the bleak, depressing reality of the political world that we live in, we were called sheep. I'm not really following the logic there, but that's why I've really been enjoying what I've been doing in the almost a year now since I got off of Twitter. My wife Christy works with me on the Overwritten Book Club. We analyze classical literature like Machiavelli's The Prince, and I've been making more and more controversial content just because I don't care anymore. Like we did a video recently called "Is Julian Assange Dead Yet?" And in that video, people were so pissed off. They said, how dare you criticize John Shipton for his inadequate activism on Assange's behalf? And it's like, does John care if I'm dead? But why do we have to kiss up to these these heroes and these sacred cows in the independent media? Like, why do we have to, oh, you're allowed to say whatever you want about the people in power, but don't you dare say anything bad about Jimmy Dore. It's like, I'm done with it. You don't get anything out of that. By kissing up to these intellectual authoritarians, whether they're in the independent media or in government, you don't get anything. You just lose respect for yourself.
All right, man. Well, where can people keep up with you? I've got a link to Overwritten and your YouTube channel. Is there anything else coming up?
Pretty much overwritten.org. I don't write a whole lot there because I'm trying to write a book about the election of 2020, which I think is going well. But I do try to produce videos on the Overwritten YouTube channel as often as possible. If people subscribe, I really appreciate that. Like I said, my wife, Christy, joins me for just every so often, especially with the Overwritten. We've had you on. You go about once a month now, then I come on. I'll have videos with D. Pierce SSC again soon. The only real announcement I have to make is you saw in that video clip you played my bookcases. This is the last video I'm making without the bookcases because tomorrow my new bookcases are being delivered at the library behind us again. So I know nobody cares about that for me, but I'm glad to have aesthetic value back on the show. I'm looking.
I got one question here. People want to see the whole gun collection. What do you got?
Well, I've only got three of the four on me right now. My shotgun is in the other room. I'm not going to go get the shotgun because it's all like zipped up and stuff. But yeah, I saw someone ask about their father's wheel gun. This is called a 38 Special. We got a 38 Special right here, which is a little too old. I'm going to have to swap that out at some point for a new one. This is my wife's favorite gun, the 22. It has a jamming problem, but we went to, on Valentine's Day, I think it was, we went to the shooting range, and she likes the 22s a lot. Maybe I'll get her one for Christmas. And then this is the Uzi. This is the 9mm. This is what happens when you got those protesters coming to your door. Kidding, just kidding. But yeah, you got to, your Uzi 9mm, unfortunately, with all of those idiot rednecks buying up all of the ammunition when the pandemic began, it's going to be hard to find affordable 9mm bullets for a while. So the Uzi I use only when I have real bad protesters at my door. But I've also got a shotgun, and at some point I'll be getting bigger and scarier guns, particularly if society continues to unravel. So that's the gun collection. And think twice before you come to my house and try to kidnap one of my cats.
All right. Well, there you go. I will be live streaming tomorrow night with Andrew from Popular Liberty. And then I'll be doing one over the weekend again with Will Bell, Liam McCollum, and Jacob Winogrand. So check in for that. I'll close us out with a short clip from, I think this was the fourth Horseman video we did, but it was about Rittenhouse. And everyone has seen this clip circulating, and I know y'all love it. So I'll just play it for you. And then we'll end after that.
No, hold on, Joseph Ryan. Rosenbaum, the Ryan, first guy, the ginger that grabbed his gun and got shot in the balls, went to jail for 13 years for raping 5-year-old twin boys. He's a communist pedophile, a communist pedophile felon that got shot in the groin, and he died doing what he loved, chasing a minor, because he was 17 years old.
Dude,
and read, it's read like, that. Whoa, read what happened? Like, shoot me, Nibba. Shoot me, Nibba. And then he gets his balls blown off. I'm like, I can't think of more just desserts than an Antifa, communist, pedophile, homosexual that gets shot in the balls. So like, he can rot in hell. He raped two little kids.
The guy defending raped two little boys.
5-year-old boys were raped by Joseph Rosenbaum. He went to prison for 13 years, gets out of jail, and tries to kill another guy. They shot at Rittenhouse first.
And by the way, Rosenbaum is
firing in the air. They're shooting at him. When he goes for the diversion, Rosenbaum dives at his gun.
We got him on the
Rittenhouse shoots him in the nuts. He dies. Then he tried to help him. Like, while he's on the ground crying, and he put a t-shirt on, whatever. Then Skater Die, who's another felon, felon, hits him with a skateboard. He gets shot in the heart. And it's like, well, you're beating a guy with a board, and he's also a felon. Then a third felon, and he's like choking women and stuff. That's what he went to jail for. Then the third guy, who's made a true lefty because he has no right arm, got shot while he's holding a gun.
Oh, this is funny. Right?
Yeah, he's got a fucking gun illegally because he got convicted for breaking and entering, and he's on probation and not supposed to have a firearm. He's pointing a gun at a guy who's down already, sitting down. So he got his arm blown off. He got disarmed, you could say.
So
fuck him. And Kyle could have shot him in the fucking head if he wanted to. He shot him in the arm that was holding the gun. I mean, that dude, you want a statue of somebody? Fuck George Fentanyl pulling guns on pregnant women and dying of goddamn methamphetamine.
Oh, man, I love this.
Put a big statue of Kyle Rittenhouse sitting down holding a gun just says tread on them.
So we're...